For our second session, we're going to have Dr. Krzysztof Ostrzeszewski. Chris is from Poland. He did his undergraduate work at the University of Łódź, both in mathematics and in philosophy. He got his PhD at the University of Washington in Seattle in mathematics. Got interested on his own in Austrian economics. Is published in the journals of the American Mathematical Association, as well as published in the American Economic Review. He's professor of mathematics at the University of Louisville, and somebody that we think is going to be playing an important role in Austrian economics in the future. One of the few economists who really understands mathematics. Chris, talk to us about Poland.
Well, it's a big claim to say that I fully understand mathematics. Unfortunately, I know how much there is to understand, so I don't know. But the world has changed quite a lot, I must say, since I left Poland. I left Poland in 1981, a couple of months before the martial law was imposed there. And when I got up in the morning today, I was watching the news. A Soviet professional boxer was shown. He was training in Japan. He was asked what his goals were, and he said, "Well, of course, I want to become well known in the professional boxing, but most of all, I want to make a lot of money." I was so impressed because when I visited the Soviet Union, I've never heard anybody saying anything like that. I just liked it very much, I have to admit. And this is a proof of another change. I will just shortly look through this. These are my computer printouts. I get an electronic computer mail newsletter from Poland, from some people of Polish Academy of Sciences in Warsaw. They sent news over the Bitnet Earn network, so I can find out quickly what's going on there. This is completely unthinkable. This was unthinkable when I left Poland. Actually, it was unthinkable about 2 years ago, but the political news seemed to change as much as the weather in Louisville recently, so I will just quickly look through this. Right now, there's a big conference meeting of solidarity going on in Gdańsk, in Poland, and because of that, the parliament is not working, which may be good news because they've been too busy almost recently. They've been passing one law after another and debating. Also, the Polish government instituted a new ministry, a new cabinet position. It's the Ministry of Free Market, which I find fascinating. Poland right now has the Ministry of Privatization and the Ministry of Free Market, maybe the only country in the world like that. They don't yet have free market, and they don't yet have a privatization, but they already on their way to get there. What else is happening? Well, of course, the Lithuanian situation is a big deal in Poland. Lithuania and Poland were in union, were one country for a long time. It wasn't always a very good deal for Lithuania, I have to admit that. But maybe there's some guilt left in Poland, and now they feel very much for Lithuania, and they're worried about the situation there, which doesn't look too good. There are big deliberations about the property of the Communist Party, which I will mention later. The unemployment in Poland right now is about 1.5%, which is about the same as in Sweden, and since both countries claim to be, well, both countries' governments want to be socialist, maybe that's the reason that they're so similar. And Swedish model is actually very popular among the leaders of the Polish government. The Polish government also now, when I left Poland, there were no advertisements on television in Poland. Right now there are advertisements, quite a lot of them, and one of them is the government advertising their long-term bonds and short-term bonds. They're selling on TV. Actually, a little kid is appearing on TV and is saying, Well, before we start the stock market, you already have a chance to invest, and you can buy government bonds. So there are quite a lot of changes there. These are the news. Also, Warsaw now has a new, what those people from this newsletter say, Warsaw has a new sheriff. That's the chief of the Warsaw police. Actually, the police situation is very interesting because the secret police was disbanded. It doesn't exist anymore. While the ordinary police became basically regular police force. Recently in Warsaw, in one of the major museums there, there was a robbery and some very valuable pieces of art were stolen. The police admitted that they were not able to find the thieves at all. So then the matter was given by the police to a subcontractor, actually a private business organized by a group of former employees of the secret police who found the pieces of art in about one day. And actually they said that this would be on the house, no charge. and it's very interesting how the country is changing. So let me first give you the title of what I will talk about. I will talk about economics, politics, Coca-Cola, and microwavable nacho cheese sauce, and I'll explain that in just a moment. Leading Wall Street money manager Mario Gabelli, who became famous especially in the 80s for his results, in a message to the shareholders of a closed-end fund that he manages, it's Gabelli Equity Trust, stated that in 1989, a pen may have been mightier than a sword, but Coca-Cola and blue jeans proved to be even more powerful. He referred to the changes in the world. Also, approximately about a year ago, when the demonstrations of the Chinese students demanding democracy and or capitalism in China started, David Letterman in his NBC late night show had in one of his regularly featured top 10 lists, the top 10 demands of Chinese students. Of the 10, the top two were number 2, democracy, human rights, microwavable nacho cheese sauce. And number 1, there are more than a billion of us, let's turn this dump over. Now the number 1 of the top 10 clearly referred to what, since the removal of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, is called the people power. Or the Filipinos have this nice expression, they say, want to stop a tank, call a Filipino. That's what they say in Manila. But number 2 restated the Mario Gabelli's message that Coca-Cola and blue jeans are quite powerful and microwavable nacho cheese sauce as well. This states that the United States may be most successful in following in its foreign policy, may be most successful if it follows the Monroe Doctrine. But I'm not referring to the what used to be called the Monroe. I'm referring to Marilyn Monroe. Or if you apply it to Japan, it should be called the Madonna Doctrine, or the Dallas Doctrine in Western Europe. That is, the United States has not had rather superior military performance. We've had some problems with that, and also the political performance wasn't always perfect. But it seems that the United States is winning the Cold War, and I believe that it's mostly because of this seductive power of capitalism. That is, the United States is extremely attractive, and it's not attractive because of our politicians or because we're helping others. It's because we have blue jeans, Coca-Cola, Marilyn Monroe, Madonna, and all that. This is what appeals to people. It's called imperialist, it's called what, all those bad things, but this is exactly what appeals to people. This is exactly what makes people look towards the United States as an ideal, and that's just the fact, I believe. Actually, I believe that 100 years from now, historians may view the Soviet adventurism in Africa, Central America, or Afghanistan just as a desperate defensive tactic of a system whose extinction was inevitable because They were losing. They were losing. They just couldn't match the Madonna doctrine. And that may be important. However, I'd like to point out to one more powerful factor changing our world, which is very rarely acknowledged in say, Time magazine, Newsweek, and popular media, and that is capital allocation. I have deep affection for Scrooge McDuck. My stepdaughter always tapes DuckTales at 4 o'clock, and we watch it together, one of my favorite shows, and I'm probably influenced by Scrooge McDuck. Let me refer again to Mario Gabelli, the famous investor, in explaining this. In his annual reports, he also always reminds himself and his shareholders the Wall Street maxim that says, money follows returns. Doesn't follow any wishes, doesn't follow dreams, hopes, just follows returns. In other words, capital is allocated to where it brings maximum profits. Of course, again, there may be attempts to do it some other way, but in the long run, the capital goes to where it brings maximum profits. I like to restate it to say, money follows virtue, because I'm convinced by Scrooge McDuck that virtue brings returns. That maxim is applied to by investors all over the world. That is, investors. I don't mean government officials. I don't mean bankers that seek protection from the government for the risk in their investing activities. I mean investors, people who are usually in their 40s, 50s, 60s with families, mortgages, rents to pay, children to raise and educate, families to support, who are very stern and serious about their money. They have a limited amount of capital. They're very serious about it. They're, in the United States, they put that money more and more often in money market accounts, not in things that are officially protected by the government. And all over the world, they tend more and more to put it in equities of productive businesses, not in government bonds, not in things that are protected from risks. But they also understand where risks are, and they try to limit the risk. They maximize returns while minimizing the risks. They just have to do it. They have limited amount of capital. And those people's decisions influence the valuations of the equities and equity markets all over the world. Well, those decisions made the investment market value investment markets value shares in, say, for example, Korean or Japanese or Taiwanese equities at a substantial premium. A Korea fund has been always sold at premium in the United States, and it will be, probably. There's got to be a reason for that. And at the same time, the Swedish and Australian investments sell consistently at a slight discount. People are not willing to pay a dollar for a dollar worth of investment in Australia. Again and again. And for example, the South African closed-end fund ASA, which is traded on the New York Stock Exchange, sells at about 25% discount. That's more than Swedish and Australian enterprises, and consistently, even though it pays such a high dividend, which is also similar to the discount given to much of the South American debt. It's also, if it's traded in the free market, it's traded at a discount. Of course, there's the exception of Chile. Chile's investments in Chile trade at premium. Again, a very interesting phenomenon. The Chile fund, which is traded as a closed-end fund on New York Stock Exchange, trades at a premium. A very interesting phenomenon, I think. And people in the open markets would not even trade Eastern European debt for a while. When there was a mention that the Soviet Union might make good on the Tsarist bonds, the markets valued those bonds hesitantly at about 10% of their official value. That is 90% discount. That is an extreme valuation, it might seem. But then again, I believe that markets don't lie, that they tell us something. They may exaggerate the truth, and they may be trendy and capricious, but they do, over the long run, reward economic performance, because after all, the Japanese market has been overvalued. That's true, but there's been some reason to that. Mr. Soichiro Honda, for example, did quite an amazing job of starting a car company against the wishes of his government officials. After all, Ministry of Industry wanted Nissan and Toyota to make cars, and yet Mr. Honda insisted that he would make good cars too. And people work very hard in Japan, so investors decided that it makes sense to invest. When the communists were writing their program of supposedly all those good things they would do when they finally had everybody by their throats, they stated they would eliminate private property. I believe that the major part of this message meant that they would remove private investors in capital markets. There's another Wall Street maxim that says that the way to make money is to accommodate people. You sell when they want to buy and buy when they want to sell. Just be very nice and do what people want you to do. And when communists announced their intentions, the private investors gladly accommodated them. Of course, there were exceptions such as Ford's factory in the Soviet Union or Mr. Armand Hammer's friendship with Lenin, but they were really exceptions. Investors generally told communists that their wishes were granted, and if the communists wanted to have funds for investments, they would need to generate those funds internally. I believe that communism survived only as long as those internal funds existed, and then a bit longer due to government-guaranteed loans from Western banks. Private investors have never been popular with politicians, be it communists or other unlimited government type. The major complaint about them has always been their risk aversion. It is the fact that they not only want the return on their capital, but the return off the capital as well. The investors are just too demanding, too careful in their credit evaluation. They are such Scrooges, you might say. Unlimited government proponents, on the other hand, would like to see credit easily available. To quote Ludwig von Mises from Human Action, they want to reduce the rate of interest to zero and thus abolish altogether the scarcity of capital. I might add here that on the loans to Eastern Europe and other similar countries, the rate of interest was actually negative. And the government guarantees helped to create such a phenomenon, to loans given at a negative rate of interest. Of course, the proponents of unlimited government have great contempt for the cruel pressure of the markets. And again, a nice quote from Human Action, Ludwig von Mises says there, "The only alternative to this financial pressure as exercised by the market is direct pressure and compulsion as exercised by the police power." I have to admit that I really like this quote, because I found it in my life, the key to my happiness was to understand the source and even to learn to love the financial pressure put on me by this system. Actually, I didn't feel much financial pressure, and I lived in Poland, I have to say, but I always felt it in this country, and I'm grateful. I'm very grateful, I have to say. The victory of communism in Russia was hailed by many as the hope of mankind. What those many meant, I believe exactly, was government's elimination of any private competition in the field of investment. Communism allowed the government of the Soviet Union to allocate capital completely arbitrarily according to the government's wishes. The victory of communism in Eastern Europe brought about the same phenomenon. In fact, communism creates that phenomenon and its consequences, that is, allocation of investment, only to field favored by the government and indifference about consumers. It will be government's preferences that will come first. So communism creates that phenomenon everywhere, wherever it goes. I must say that it was quite fascinating and amazing for me to see news clips from Cuba, where I saw lines in grocery stores, and people looked so different, and yet at the same, as far as their facial features, and yet the lines themselves were so similar to the ones I saw in Poland when I lived there, when I was a child. And after all, the history and the culture of Poland and Cuba are quite different. I can hardly imagine anything more different than these two. A popular joke in Poland states that communists could not have erred, because errors should be distributed randomly and should produce disasters only half of the time, while communists destroyed everything they touched. And I think there is some truth to that, to that common wisdom. When government is free to allocate capital as it pleases, be it financial or human capital, it allocates it to maximize its power. And as this goal is generally in direct contradiction with the interest of the consumers, the result of such allocation results are also in direct conflict with what consumers need. From the investor's perspective, communist economic management was, and I'll quote from an expression by a Polish economist, Ernest Skalski, it was management by an imbecile. There's a Polish saying, to buy high and sell low, to marry badly, any imbecile can do that. Now, the economies of communist countries are, in a way, in a worse shape than those of underdeveloped third world countries. The third world lacks industrial infrastructure. Communist world has it, but the structure is designed to buy high and sell low, to take in expensive materials and labor and turn out a worthless product, all done in the name of government's glory. Their economy is a system designed to suck in any value found and shred it into pieces. Now, the first value destroyed was all of the financial and human capital obtained cheaply when communists took over. When that source dried out in Poland, that was around 1970, the government turned to foreign loans. And the Western banks, prodded by the governments, provided the money. After all, the perception was that it is natural for governments to borrow money. And we are used to that. Somehow we got convinced that this is natural. I would like to point out that it may not be, but just a thought. But of course, the value shredding machine in Poland kept on shredding. It was the same machine, just got new stuff to destroy. By 1980, approximately, the money was spent and no new values were created. So what happened then? Well, it was very difficult to borrow money, although the communists were saying, well, we are in such great need. Please give us the money. Oh, please, we need it. But the Western banks were beginning to have some problems with those loans, and they were very reluctant. They were basically saying, well, of course, if the United States government, for example, guarantees the loan, then maybe, but we don't know. Actually, as I recall, in 1981, as a result of all those policies, the United States government paid interest on the Polish loans of about, in the amount of, as I recall, about $600 million. So, You may consider this your tax money at work. What happened then? In Poland, the government, in their last desperate attempt to preserve their political existence, turned to inflation. But it was a very interesting form of inflation, because by that time there were two currencies in circulation in Poland. Polish money called złoty and dollars. Dollars became basically a second currency. In 1981, when I was leaving Poland, the rate of exchange was 120 zloty to $1. Inflation picked up greatly because the communists were printing money and running deficits. But actually, the prices started galloping ahead if calculated in Polish money, in złoty. But they were slowly falling if calculated in dollars. Because with all this feverish attention to politics, inflation, other spectacular events, and solidarity and everything, the attention was in politics. The economy became a second subject. Well, the economy started to gradually contract, even though it had all the maybe symptoms of growing, and the government was trying to make it look as if it was growing. By 1988-89, the contraction became quite severe. A bottle of Polish-made Coca-Cola in Poland cost about a penny, if you pay in dollars. But people just could not buy it, because goods became infinitely scarce, and an average monthly salary slipped to about $20 per month, again, if you use the black market rate of exchange in your calculation. In June 1989, as a result of partly free election and a negotiated deal between Solidarity and the Communists, the Communist power monopoly was gone. The Communists received a guaranteed 65% of the seats in the lower house of the parliament. That was lowered eventually through some deals made. Some people stepped down, but they still have officially a majority in the lower house of the parliament, which is called Sejm. But in that part of the election, which was free, they lost in a spectacular way. That is, not a single communist was elected. All of the candidates proposed by Solidarity, but one, were elected. The one was not was an independent who was running on a pro-capitalist platform. He was a businessman from the province. So Solidarity, which was banned by the martial law decree of December 13, 1981, became almost a monopolist on the Polish political scene. The election was rather quick, and it came before the changes in other Eastern European countries. It may be important to remember that maybe the non-communist or not fully communist government in Poland came first, but it came before all the other changes, and because of that, the changes, at first the changes in Poland were actually less radical than the changes in that happened later politically in East Germany and Czechoslovakia. Solidarity went into this election slightly divided, as there were some people very influential in the movement who did not support the accord with the communists, people such as Andrzej Gwiazda, Marian Jurczyk, or Andrzej Rospuchowski. But it was very well organized, and it was non-communist. As the rest of the opposition was rather unprepared, it lost just as badly as the communists. Let me add here that there is a very popular pro-capitalist writer in Poland whose name is Piotr Wierzbicki. In early 80s, he wrote a book about the Polish right. Let's generally put it this way. Let's say that people who are for some form of capitalism in Poland, let's call them right. And he stated that the underdevelopment of that part of the political spectrum in Poland needs to be traced to the time between 1948 and 1956. In those years, if you liked capitalism anyway, you were shot. So, of course, any kind of understanding of the theory of evolution teaches us that if this is the incentive that you get for this kind of opinions, those kind of opinions may disappear. So to the voters, Solidarity clearly appeared to be the only alternative to communism. And, of course, clearly the voters rejected communism all the way. But Solidarity came out of the election with one problem. It did not have a program. It was under a strong domination of former communists forced into opposition by the Communist Party hardening of attitudes. The two main ideologues of Solidarity were Jacek Kuroń and Adam Michnik. Kuroń, who once had been an active leader of the communist youth organizations, was jailed in the 60s together with another once communist, now Solidarity activist and senator, Karol Modzelewski, for merely writing an open letter to the Communist Party. They just wrote the letter and then they were imprisoned. Those people had a program of taking power away from the communists, but they did not have a program for restructuring the economy of Poland, a monstrous value-shredding machine managed by an imbecile. The communists obviously did not have a program either. Did anyone have it? Well, yes, there were people who were thinking about economics at that time when everybody was thinking about politics, about how to get rid of the communists. That was the first question. Then finally people started about the economic program, but before that there had been people who thought about the economic program. I'm going to discuss three such groups. But at this point I would like to make one comment about the modern world as compared to the world about 30 or 40 years ago. It used to be that proponents of socialism were very fierce ideologues, while those defending capitalism were quiet and reserved pragmatists. Now, those days are gone, and I'm very happy about that. Now, socialists are dressed in suits and ties and talk about free market socialism, which is a contradiction in terms, I think. And they're no longer so passionate. They don't scream anymore. They try to speak softly, and they make an effort to appear rational, which is difficult, I think, if you're a socialist. But at the same time, they face very fierce and very committed proponents of capitalist acts between consenting adults who have the flame of the West in their eyes. And fortunately, there are people like that in Poland, too. The first of the three program-holding groups was called Konfederacja Polski Niepodległy, which translates as Confederacy for Independent Poland, led by Leszek Maczulski. Their program was formulated in the late 70s, first stated by Maczulski's popular and then banned book Rewolucja bez rewolucji, which means revolution without having a revolution. To present it shortly, Maczulski intended to privatize small and medium-sized businesses, relax greatly government controls over the economy, while keeping government's role in heavy industries, monetary policies, insurance, and overall supervision. That's basically a welfare state-style vision, and he definitely referred in his statements to West German economy of the 70s. That was basically his ideal. And since I don't agree with that program, I present it only shortly. I have to admit that I don't. The second group of less political affluence but stronger pro-capitalist conviction and a very active following among entrepreneurs and intellectuals was Krakowskie Towarzystwo Przemysłowe, which means Krakow Industrial Society. Krakow is a city in southern Poland. It was founded around 1986 by a group of intellectuals in the southern city of Krakow. The undisputed leader of the group was Mirosław Dzielski, a conservative pro-capitalist philosopher and writer, deeply religious, combining Catholicism with capitalism in a very erudite manner, quite typical for the tradition of that part of Poland it came from, which is called Galicia. It's a Polish term for the Polish territories within the Austro-Hungarian Empire of the 19th century. Now, the correlation with the Austrian economics may not be purely coincidental here. In fact, Galicia was strongly influenced by the classical liberal tradition of the Austrians, that of Menger, von Mises, and Hayek. Krakow Industrial Society started as informal gatherings of intellectuals and entrepreneurs from the area in which experiences and ideas were exchanged. They were not, however, gatherings with the purpose of promoting a program, but just to have fun. The meetings were, in fact, organized as celebrated dinners. The cuisine was the main attraction. In time, intellectuals learned that entrepreneurs were by far more interesting to talk to than politicians, while the businessmen found that they were not left alone in their permanent struggle with all intrusive government. In the process, the intellectuals formulated their ideas about what Poland should be like after communism. Unlike the ideologues of the left, Michnik and Kuroń, they did not study ways of removing the communist government, but rather what to replace it with. Looking back at the statements and writings of the members of the Krakow Industrial Society, I found it fascinating that it seems that they thought it obvious that communism would fall, and soon. That fact was clearly not so obvious to many Sovietologists in the West. Sadly, Mr. Dzielski, the charismatic leader of the society, died in 1989, the year when many of his ideas triumphed, and Mr. Tadeusz Syrejczyk of the society became the Minister of Industry in the new government of Mr. Tadeusz Mazowiecki, the first non-communist government in the Soviet bloc. But this expression, non-communist government, is not precise. As the communists hold three cabinet positions in the government, and actually the government is a wide coalition from the extreme left through the center. There is one large political party fully excluded from the government. Its members and followers was once described by the Soviet news agency TASS as sort of California-style flakes. When they marched in Warsaw in 1989 with slogan, "Capitalism Now." After all, it may seem too strange to demand capitalism. Everyone knows it's a system of exploitation of man by fellow man. Unlike socialism, a system of senseless beating of men by fellow men. I have to add that actually, that's another thing I learned. I learned to like the system when living in this country. I learned to like the system of exploitation of men by fellow men. And I'm serious. It sounds maybe funny, but I'm serious. I would like to be exploited by University of Louisville more. I'd say about $50,000 a year or more. But they're not willing yet. So we'll see what happens. The most colorful, and I have to admit my favorite person of that group of flakes, is Mr. Janusz Korwin-Mikke. He's the leader of Unia Polityki Realnej, which by its members is translated as Union for Realpolitik. And I think they're referring to the meaning of the word Realpolitik in Mises' Human Action. Again, he uses that word. For example, he makes a statement there, in the long run, there is no such thing as an unpopular government. One way or another, it will be removed. It doesn't have to be replaced by a better one, but it will be removed. So maybe that's the meaning, although I prefer the translation that it's a union for rational politics, because that's really what they appear to be. Mr. Korwin-Mikke originally intended to be a mathematician, but during his studies at the University of Warsaw in 1964, he came up with this idea of writing an open letter to the communist authorities, and you know what it meant. That is, he ended up in jail. He was released in quite a short period of time, but apparently did not change his ideas and was arrested again in 1968. In the 70s, he became active in research in cybernetics and played bridge. He became one of the best in Poland. In 1979, he started a publishing house, Oficina Liberałów, which still exists and publishes classical, liberal, conservative, and other pro-capitalist works. When Solidarity started in the early 80s, Mr. Korwin-Mikke attempted to influence the program, to shift it away from socialism, but that brought him another imprisonment during the martial law. If I were to describe that man, he may not look this way, but he behaves that way. That is, I would describe him as Mr. Spock, accelerated by about 75%. He's very energetic and moves very fast and speaks a bit like Mr. Spock. Let me present shortly the program. I'll refer to it as UPR. That stands for Unia Polityki Realnej. Here are the main points. Number one, reduction in government expenditures. Number two, gold, silver standard for the Polish currency. Number three, reduction in taxes and simplification of the tax codes. Number four, complete privatization of government-owned companies and elimination of any economic activities by the government. Five, elimination of government controls over wages and prices. Six, separation of the executive, legislative, and the judiciary branches of the government. Seven, lowering of tariffs and gradual complete elimination of them. Eight, ending the state's schooling monopoly. Nine, elimination of censorship. 10, abolition of forced military conscription and introduction of defense based on voluntary professional army. Actually, some of these things were already done by the Solidarity government. Because Solidarity did not have a program while those people did. That's one of the phenomena in Poland right now, that if you have a program in Poland, the government actually may implement it even though they may not agree with it, because they don't have one. UPR stresses individual rights, freedom of any lawful economic activity for the citizens, and property rights. It clearly and openly stands for capitalism, unlike other pro-capitalist movements, which are not that open about saying it. What is the perspective for capitalism in Poland? Let me start here with this answer with one remark made by Mr. Raymond Hutchings, who is a British Soviet studies specialist, visited recently the University of Louisville. He stated that revolutions are often caused by an understandable anxiety, because if you proceed slowly with reforms, you give the opposition to reforms time to consolidate, time to find ways to stop the reforms. Reforms in Poland are painfully slow, and this may prove to be potentially dangerous in every way. After all, if the revolution is violent, you cannot be certain of its outcome. Since January 1st, 1990, Poland has been undergoing an economic overhaul orchestrated by Mr. Balcerowicz of Mr. Mazowiecki's government. The design for the plan comes from several sources, but the influence of Dr. Jeffrey Sachs of Harvard University is of major importance. In my opinion, the plan resembles a bit the plan of Mr. Paul Volcker when he took over the chairmanship of the Federal Reserve and subsequently had the inflation rate lowered in the United States. And I think that one of the side effects of Mr. Volcker's plan work was a great increase in real interest rates, which stayed with us until now and added to some problems. So I like having inflation going down, but there are some problems with the way it's done. The main objective of the plan of Mr. Balcerowicz was bringing down the rate of inflation. In 1989, the Polish economy witnessed a shift from a single-digit monthly inflation to double digits, with peak of over 50% monthly rate of inflation in January 1990. What is rarely mentioned is the fact that in the last months of ruling Poland, communists ran the largest budget deficit ever in the history of Poland. The total 1989 deficit was estimated by UPR in their open letter to the parliament at about $8 billion. For a country carrying $40 billion external debt with a sick economy, it was quite a spending spree. The plan of Mr. Balcerowicz was based on fixing the rate of exchange of the Polish currency to the U.S. dollars at 9,500 and immediate balancing of the government's budget. Prices were allowed to be set by the market. The Solidarity government promised not to yield to any pressures of special interest groups. For the first 3 months of 1980, the promise was kept. Now some things are happening that indicate that it's not. And inflation went from 50% monthly to somewhere between 2% and 5%. But the picture is not as bright as the figures may suggest. No privatization efforts were made, and the government is still the owner of all large enterprises. Those enterprises drastically cut production. The estimates for the drop in production run as high as 50%. Prices stabilized at levels where many goods became completely unavailable to average person. Many Poles, for example, gave up registration of the cars and turned in license plates as the registration fee and gasoline sold by the state monopoly became prohibitively expensive. Taxes and tariffs were raised drastically in order to bring government revenue above its expenses. All exporting businesses are required to sell their foreign currency holdings to the state. Again, no privatization was performed. Some grocery stores were sold off, and actually buying food is no longer a problem in Poland because of that. But that's partly caused by the fact that the retailing business is the one that is the closest to bankruptcy. They were probably sold because they were bankrupt. The state-owned large enterprises are frantically selling their assets, actually, now because they can't make money through production. So, for example, they sell trucks. And trucks are very popular with entrepreneurs. They use them to take goods from this place to that place. Distribution is almost no problem anymore in Poland. It's the production that is a problem, and government owns the means of production. One major change has occurred. It is no longer an economy of an imbecile. The resources and capital are at least partially allocated efficiently. There's a quick test of whether the country is communist or not. The question is, can you buy toilet paper? And yes, you can buy toilet paper in Poland now, no problem. You can buy just about anything. It's expensive. Gasoline costs $1.25 per gallon. That's expensive for them. Actually, by European standards, it's cheap. The Poles just celebrated Christmas and Easter, and this Easter that they celebrated was probably the first one when buying ham, turkey, bread, or all the other special holiday items was not an impossible struggle. Just they had to budget it. That was it. The government of Mr. Mazowiecki is very popular. They're not communists, and it really works for them. That any non-communist government that is trying to do something would be popular in this situation. The electronic newsletter I mentioned of April 17 states that based on the statistical service performed by some group of Polish Academy of Sciences, 90% of the population give Mr. Mazowiecki a positive rating, and 53% supported Mr. Balcerowicz, who instituted the program of economic reform, despite the fact that he is blamed for high prices, and yet people still approve him. Polish economist Jadwiga Staniszkis says about people's feelings about the situation, that living in the world which makes no sense is much worse than living in poverty. People now feel that they may live in poverty, but the world makes sense finally. But there are problems. There has been a long time proponent of capitalism in Poland, Mr. Stefan Kisielewski, called Kisiel, which means jello, a writer and a composer who writes a column in the Catholic Weekly, Tygodnik Powszechny. He always advocated capitalism in it, and he was treated as some kind of a weirdo, basically. That's why he was allowed to do that. He states that Poland badly lacks investors, entrepreneurs, and managers, exactly people whose roles were taken over by the communist government. There are bureaucrats who do everything they can to stifle the progress. In smaller cities, the bureaucrats insist that you have to get this license and that license and that license, sometimes 30 licenses, for example, just to have a truck that we would use to take food from this place to that place. And of course, there is a great delay in privatization caused mostly by the people from the Communist Party in the lower house of the parliament. The Communist Party dissolved itself, and those people formed two parties. One is called the Union of Social Democrats of Polish Republic, and the other one is called, I think, just Social Democrats of Polish Republic. They have almost identical names. But that Union of Social Democrats claims to be the sole owner of all buildings and other properties of the former Communist Party. And just happened almost, that's how it's perceived, but of course it was a result of hard work. But it did not require the redistribution of assets. And the redistribution is already happening. Those inefficient government enterprises are just selling because they can't do anything. It may be a bit unfair that the assets stolen by the communists still remain with the state, and I perfectly agree with that point, but in the long run, the investors will take care of it. If the communists are inefficient, they will not get their toys. They're just not behaving, and they will not get their toys. The market is like a very stern father. You've got to get good grades, that's when you will get the money, and if you don't get A's, then you won't. The communists just don't perform, and that's it. Also, there will be an election in Poland this month for local governments, and next year they're supposed to be talking about an election to the parliament. And I understand that the East Germans may have voted for the conservatives because they wanted to be incorporated in West Germany faster, but I think that there is something to such a big amount, a percentage of population voting the way they voted in Nicaragua, in Hungary, in East Germany. I think that there is something of a vote for capitalism in it. And I am quite convinced that in the next election in Poland, the number of people voting for a capitalist program, not pro-capitalist program, not against the communists, but for capitalism, will greatly increase. And that's also a point that makes me optimistic. Thank you.
We have about 5 minutes. Chris, come back. Go. Just in case anybody has a question.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yes.
Does this Union for Political Reality have a plan to run candidates in the West?
Yes, definitely. I actually have their leaflets and other things from their campaign for the first election, if you want to look at it. This was part of their program from the first election that they did. Yes.
Just besides the taking more credit than he deserved, being afforded by the people who he said he had helped, in Latin America, in the case of Bolivia, for the minister of Bolivia, just no. Most of this was our plan, but Jeffrey Sachs appears as being an engineer of the Bolivian miracle. What is the true case in Poland?
That may be, again, the same situation, but there is one magic thing about him. He is an American economist. America is, after all, a symbol of capitalism. And in Poland, that makes it that makes him famous instantaneously, that he is an American economist. He must be good. That's an assumption. I'm sorry that it's like that. So people want him to be the engineer of the reform, which may not necessarily be the case. There is, for example, a strong pressure from the International Monetary Fund for the Polish government to balance their budget and to do certain things. And I don't think he has much to do with that. Also, people expect capitalism in Poland. They're complaining that it's cruel, that it may be cruel, that they're unemployed. Oh, what are we going to do? But it's generally accepted that that's what's going to happen. I think that there's a need to have a hero, and he just naturally came into that spot. That's all. I don't think that his role is that great. I actually tend to. I don't know, this is not really a Marxist point of view, but I think that an individual does not have such an overwhelmingly important role when compared to other individuals in the history. There is a gradation. Some people have less influence on events and some people have more, but influence of famous people, I think, is usually greatly exaggerated, and I think his is as well. On the other hand, the fact that he is a symbol of capitalism, that maybe helps in getting people to think that capitalism will come. And as long as they want that, maybe I'm such a bad compromiser that I would even allow a Keynesian temporarily to do his job as long as we get closer to capitalism. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Is that mostly under
the advice of the IMF? That's my understanding. I don't know the details of, well, after all, the government just issued the decree and that was it. It could be the influence of the IMF. It sounded like it from, when they were attacked for it, they said, look, please understand that we really have no choice. The International Monetary Fund stated, this is one of the conditions that we better balance the budget.
Can you get all more specific on what kind of taxes
I would have to look into my materials. I know that my father, who was running a small business, just decided to close it down for a while because he couldn't pay the new taxes. They were at least doubled for him. Well, it's not the government, for example, made it illegal to import any kind of liquor that contains more than 30% of alcohol, and then raise taxes on other liquors. Well, they have a monopoly on sales of liquor in Poland, so they wanted the revenue, I guess. By the way, Poland is now apparently getting loans from the International Monetary Fund and also from several Western countries. I'm not happy about it at all, but that's what's happening.
I'll just mention the two things that the OECD advisors told Poland were the two key reforms they had to institute with the central bank and an IRS. Actually, the central bank, Western economic authority.
Yes. We had one more question.
Yeah, on the political front, is there any movement toward a Green Party? And if so, how effective have they been and how effective do you think they'll be in the future?
Yes, there is some, and I think the strongest with the group called, in Polish it's called Wolność I Pokój, which means freedom and peace. As far as popularity, I would say not very popular. The political spectrum is dominated by, I would say, politics from center to the left, the social democratic program of some kind. That's why the communists call themselves social democrats, because they want to be put into that group. And that group has this great dominance over the voters. It might be changing because people would like to have the changes in the economy happening more quickly. Now, as far as the environmental situation, it is very bad, but it's not perceived by the population as the number one problem. They want it solved after they are able to buy their bread and have an apartment to live in. They want it solved, but they want it solved after those basic needs are met. As far as environment, again, the situation is probably much worse than in any Western European country.